critical observation.
Which was?
I didn't read it.
Oh,
the prologue.
I love it too. And I think the more you get into The Hobbits, the more you love it. So going back to it after you've read the novel, it's even more fun. But basically, exposition is a kind of boring but necessary part of novels. It's one of the hardest, if you're a creative writer, it's one of the hardest things to do, to make the exposition interesting and not, you know, get the reader that necessary information about what the world's like, where these characters live, who they are, while holding the reader's attention. So Chris's reaction is not inappropriate. Unless, you know, Tolkien does a pretty good job of it. And the movie had exposition as well, but that, and so put it in there, exposition, but it's rare. You rarely see a movie with that much exposition in it. Do you think you would have tolerated that exposition if you hadn't previously known about the Tolkien world in a movie? No, how long would it go on?
I think they would, because, I mean, it's still visually, it's aesthetically appealing,
so
and
they
it's
use,
kind of
they
interesting.
Use pretty pictures. They throw in pretty pictures.
And,
just visual pleasures.
It seemed
visual
epic.
Pleasures.
It made it seem epic, like you were delving
okay.
into a bigger universe than what you were looking at.
Nice, I like that. So, visual pleasure, and then another happy face, let's go with epic scope. Visual pleasure, epic scope. Both of those are the way the movie made it feel better. There was no epic scope in the novel prologue, I don't think. In the novel prologue, it was much more homey, you know? It was the local pleasures. So the movie added something. You know, and of course it was getting ready for the big time battles. And I knew that you were paying for those CGI battles where hundreds of thousands of orcs and humans and elves clashed. And so it was ramping you up for that.
I think one thing that made the prologue fun for me was
mm-hmm.
I was reading that while I was kind of exploring the Shire in the game. So I was reading about some things and then I kind of noticed it, like they kind of threw it in there in the game. That was fun. So
again, you know, just give us a game smiley face. Oh, you're making a correction.
Yeah.
A game smiley face for in the game illusion again. Illusion works in setting in the game. If there's an original, just seeing those sights is fun, if you know it. And if you don't know it, nothing's lost. It's just an environment. It's a virtual world. Is that the only way you get a setting in a novel exposition?
Scene change.
How do they pull off a scene change?
Chapter change.
How do they pull off a chapter change? They just put in a chapter heading then? Tell me more. I mean, you're onto something.
Well, they just have to describe the setting with words every time they want you to imagine something new.
I have to describe it with words. And you remember you had Sam sitting there, and then Sam goes out into the night air, and there's, you know, it's a cool night air with the stars twinkling. But in the movie, if they'd shown him emerge from there, it would have been more than just cool night air, stars twinkling. You'd been seeing a whole nighttime scene with everything that the camera captured and everything that the director put in there to be captured. What is it, those of you that have done movie work, what is it called, the person that keeps all the items on the set straight? Kind of that term. Do you all remember that term? I'll do it.
The straight guy.
What? The stage manager? Not
stage.
No, it's not that. But there's a name for the
prop guy.
What?
Prop guy.
But, you know, and he registers, or
prop
she
master.
Registers, you know, draws, you know, probably uses cameras, photos, quick photos by now, digital photos, but he records the position to the millimeter of every single item so that when they have take two, they can reset it so that it's exactly the same. So let's say visual surround for movies. Visual surround, as in the model of surround sound. You've got a visual visualscape, a surround, you know, visual surround. And novels have
building blocks, I guess.
Yeah,
it's just fundamental elements, and then you kind of create your own world around it.
Just say, you know, for novel, minimal details. Minimal details. Say. And minimal is an important word. The novelist wants to put the exact minimum that will accomplish her purpose. Too many, and you're in a 19th century novel. You know, too many, and you're going, okay. Because the 19th century, they were romantics. This is my favorite period, so I shouldn't be ironic about them. They were romantics. They loved to describe nature. So you get to a great big 19th century novel, and they walk onto a new landscape, and you get three fat paragraphs of the trees and the mountains and the little gurgling brooks and, you know, everything that they tell you about. Because in the 19th century, the minimal details were more than we like in the 20th century. We've been spoiled by Hemingway, who says, they were standing at a bar. Jake said, "Hit me again, barkeep." "Double?" "Yeah." Typical Hemingway passage, richly descriptive, right?
He tugged on a fishing line as the Marlin pulled the boat.
There you go. Good. We switch from "Sun Also Rises" to "Old Man in the Sea."
The Marlin pulled harder. His fingers started bleeding.
Good. You see, you can do it. But that's a real dramatic change in the taste and descriptive and setting. But anything else you want to say about how setting is realized? What about in the games? Yeah, Chris, you have a thought?
Like a time shift? Mobile and
is really
time is important.
World,
like, in the game, if we stay in the place, we'll stay there, like, unless we play the game.
Way at the bottom, just put, just write that down there where your hand is. Just say, game. How do you want to describe time for the game?
Stops if you're not logged in is what his example was.
Time frozen. Right. At.
Is there a time in real Earth, like, in the game? Because
there isn't. Yeah, there is.
There is.
Like time frozen at your stage. That's a lot, but we'll just say that. And we're not gonna go through time. We'll do time another day. But Chris is so right that. One of the things we saw about time was how disproportionate the playing time was to the narrative time. That is, to run from the Shire to, you know, to breathe. It's interesting, it was both slower and faster. It was, if you read that it took him 4 days, you read one sentence. And so running there took a lot more. But in this other odd way, taking 15 minutes to run is a lot faster than 4 days. So there's a kind of disproportionality that can go both directions of time inside a game. And that's all we'll say about time right now. Time is so crucial when we're creating our own game space. Setting and time are probably the two hardest things to master. As Matt Shelton can tell you about, it's easy to make a character in that game. But to handle time and space in a world, to make a world that the player experiences, takes a lot more thought than just to make a character. I mean, you make a character every time you log on to a new game. Bing, bing, bing. I think Sam had his hand up, and then we'll go to you.
No, sorry.
I don't know about this, but you could also say that in the novel, when you don't have a visual aid to work off of, you can say that although they don't necessarily have to describe it, like certain cultures or races, such as like elves or hobbits, like should you like make the image in your mind of like sort of a similar setting group of, which like Rivendell and Lothlorien, like they weren't the same, but they had like they were both like green and almost like mystical kind of. So you can kind of like carry that over without
So what are you saying?
Like it doesn't have to be written, for the, but you can kind of like make certain culture within it, and like group of people, you can kind of imply settings.
I read the word implied settings. That's a really interesting
thing. Sam, you're saying that like
there.
The elves have
like,
some
yeah,
sort
like,
of implied setting.
Yeah,
with
like,
them.
If, like you could say like even... they could have described the Rivendell, for example, and they could say the Fellowship walked into Lothlorien, another elven city, and then you can automatically start there.
Because it's in your imagination.
Then,
Bingo, that's so right. Implied setting, I love that term. And, you know, dwarves. You went with elves, think about dwarves. You even have pre-existing settings in mind for dwarves. So, actually, you might add to that conventional settings. So that's what I mean by pre-existing setting, is that you kind of have an idea of what a dwarf setting is going to be. And if you go into the dwarf housing area in the game, you'll see a pretty cool example of your pre-existing idea of what a dwarf house would be like. Yes?
No, I forgot what to say.
Oh, God. I've been on so long. I hate that when I do that.
I'm just too tired because I was watching Almost Famous last night.
You were watching what?
Almost Famous.
Did I sign that? I didn't remember that.
Let's see if they can remediate that.
Maybe that's true. Let's stop this. We're going to come back to this chart later. This has really been useful, Dan. You've been a great
Dan,
job.
Dan, wonderful job. Let's hear it for Dan.
Yeah,
Dan. Thank
yeah.
you.
And let's move on to remediation, because we're talking about our experience as consumers of these media, but now let's think about producing these media with this book by Bolter and Grusin, Remediation. You had to read it for last Thursday. Pretty tough piece of reading. How did y'all find it?
Tough.
Confusing.
Boring.
Tough.
Boring.
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 Yeah,
it's
dense.
A little bit. It was a big kind of more of an introduction before I started getting into why that we were reading it. Kind of.
So, this book has been very influential. You're so influential. You'll see shortly that. We're going to show you a YouTube video posted by a media expert in Australia about remediation. It's been a huge academic hit. It is a tough piece of reading, but it's not any tougher than the stuff that you're going to need to learn to deal with in your higher level courses. And last year when we were recording everything and putting this on the internet, on iTunes every week, I asked, how'd y'all like it? Everyone day went, oh, boring, awful, it was so hard, just groaning and moaning like that. And then I said, well, in fact, one of the authors is a close friend of mine, Richard Grusin. It was hilarious. Everybody immediately goes, oh, it was so cool, way cool.
But the big thing was Professor Clayton had told him that his podcast about remediation would be on iTunes.
And so he tuned in. He tuned in, heard the iPod, and he goes, okay, well, I'll try and write clearer next time.
The whole point of the article is to equip you with a set of vocabulary and some analytical frameworks as you approach, this is what Dan facilitated up here for us, is to help facilitate those thinking processes as you approach these varied works in different media. So it's a wonderful tool.
So why don't you take her away and show this video?
Well, okay, let's go two components. Before we jump right into the video, I want to say, what were the two elements of the double logic of remediation? What were they?
Immediacy.
I hear it, immediacy and?
Hypermediacy.
Not hypermediacy. Hypermediacy?
Hypermediacy.
There you go. Hypermediation.
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 You know, I would count hypermediacy.
I'd like to be a wee bit more
hypermediacy.
I had a hyper down that I couldn't think of it.
It's good enough for government work, but it gets the two. Let's talk about it. The hypermediation and immediacy. Jim, what's immediacy?
I'm not terribly clear on the distinction between these terms, so.
I just know the relationship with one, like, I just know they relate to one of them is, like, the use of, like, forms of media, or something like art, and then, like, one's not.
What's something immediate? I mean, just think about the term. You think of a first-person shooter as an example of an immediacy?
Yeah. It's like,
if you can't tell me what it is, show me an example. Just tell me an example.
A sense of urgency to it.
Well, I think it's, think of something from a first-person perspective. You know, you're launching a, if you
dodgeball.
It's having a dodgeball thrown at the camera. Isn't that a sense of immediacy? What would be an example of hypermediation?
What page? And like having multiple variables, I guess, right in front of you. Yeah. Pick your medium.
Be a melange of media stitched together. So that's, and remember, the hyper part of this is that you can move into and through and around. And those are some key topics as we move into this cyberspace discussion we'll have around Snow Crash and Neal Stephenson. But let's show you, I want to show you a video that came from the Australian media expert. It's up here on YouTube. And
yeah,
and it's a, I've got it on my speakers, Jay.
I was going to go to sign.
Oh, on the
lights.
Thanks, Jody. I'm the remediated version of Jody. Can't tell you how thrilling that is, but more about that in a moment. When we're talking about screen culture and digital media, what do we mean when we're talking about immediacy, hypermediacy, and remediation? Okay, I think immediacy is how much the user or interactor forgets the medium in favor of the content or the task.
Boy, I can't wait.
So, when watching a film in a cinema, immediacy would be referring to how engrossed a person is in the storytelling.
My God, you must really love this picture.
Me?
You've been here all day, and I've seen you here twice before.
You mean me?
Yes!
And at the same time, how little that person is thinking about things like film techniques, such as special effects or editing.
It's an old sport, you're on the wrong side.
Filmmaker Woody Allen had some fun with the concept in his classic film The Purple Rose of Cairo.
Yeah, maybe you should just turn the projector off.
No! Don't turn the projector off! No, no, it gets black and we disappear. Don't turn the projector off.
We need to stay too.
Another example is, when sitting at a computer screen using a software program, immediacy would be referring to a low level of conscious use of tools such as the mouse, the keyboard, and menu commands. The less intrusion of these tools into the awareness, the higher the level of immediacy experienced. We all know someone who's an expert at a particular software program. Well, when they're using it, they would be experiencing a high level of immediacy, because their expertise with the program's functions frees up their conscious thinking to focus on the content or other intellectual demands.
I just getting some coffee. Tell some stories how I save your ass every day. Can't remember to help me. I got coffee. Thank you. Danny Woodley, twin for the Fed. Oops. Got it.
Immediacy is also known as transparency, and as an artistic practice, it's been going on for ages. As far back as the Roman times, artists have been having a go at it. The trompe l'oeil painting and mural employ two techniques common to all versions of immediacy and transparency: linear perspective and what's called erasing the surface. Today's virtual reality programming, perhaps the most extreme attempts of immediacy, express these same two techniques of linear perspective and erasing the surface, but obviously in a digital realm. Okay, hypermediacy. It's the technique of multiple and concurrent acts of representation on the same visual plane. Once again, the practice is not new. Michelangelo's paint job on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, depicting different stories from the Bible, is an example from the Renaissance era. I believe hypermediacy has really come of age in the digital era. While the desktop metaphor was an attempt at immediacy on the computer screen, the Windows environment is a hypermediated form, with the potential of lots of windows containing content open concurrently. Since then, the technique has cross-pollinated into other formats, TV, gaming, in web design as an answer to the challenges faced by information architects. And in cinema, it's known as spatial montage, which the guys talked about in the tutorial last week. So I thought an interesting point made by the media theorists in our course manual is that hypermediacy is a counterbalance to immediacy. That is, immediacy is all about the user forgetting that they're interacting with a medium, while hypermediacy is the opposite. A user is extremely aware that they are interacting with a medium. I'm not sure I agree. I think user sophistication is getting to a point of hypermediated immediacy. At any rate, I believe that hypermediacy is a defining characteristic of online interaction. Just check out this YouTube page. It's a very nice example of hypermediacy. And as an observer sitting there, think about how much information you have access to all at once, just at a glance. And that's before you've even started clicking on links and opening new windows. And then there's Facebook, which uses hypermediacy to enhance the notion of a popularity contest, allowing a user in a number of different ways to view how many friends they've got and how many networks they connect to. So for me, digital hypermediacy is all about concurrent connection to lots of different information. So finally, remediation. It's the act of absorbing and repurposing media into another media format. Or as I've come to think of it, regurgitation. It's so prevalent these days, I found that at first it can be really hard to focus on as a concept because it's in your face, it's everywhere. We live in a remediated culture. Do you know, a short while after I started reading and thinking about remediation, I had this sudden and big self-realization which forced me to reassess a huge part of my own professional history. But to explain what I'm talking about, I'm going to hand over from my remediated self in my hypermediated environment to my flesh and blood self in the old school face-to-face environment. Over to you, Jody. Pleasure.
Well, we'll have to be the virtual Jody to talk about this. That was an interesting discussion. This is when she was looking around and looking about, those were the links in the context. If you were to look at it in this space, you had a hypermediated environment. The immediacy idea is, it's like Evan was saying, dodgeball, you feel you're immersed, you're there. That Woody Allen film is a great example. And you've had those moments. Can you think of any moment where you've experienced immediacy?
Watching Lord of the Rings. I was just like in the
movie. What? Speak up.
I was watching Lord of the Rings, and I was like during the scene where like all the orcs swarm that hill, and there was like a huge battle. You just feel like you're there. If you're really watching, you're just like you gotta snap out of it.
Playing Civilization, I guess, just kind of like you just get so into it, like you feel like you're actually the one controlling what's going on.
Isn't that wild? That is actually Jody's point that she disagrees a little bit with old Turinggerson. She's saying that immediacy now is being achieved through hypermediation, because in Civilization you've got little pop-up screens all over the place, you know, controlling the gameplay there, and that increases your immediacy. You feel like you're a Roman or whatever.
I wonder if Steve Wiebe and Billy had some immediacy going in their lives at some point.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I particularly like the word transparent. They've been using that word about writers' styles for centuries now. realistic fiction is regarded as transparent because you're supposed to see through the words on the page to an imagined world. And that's a definition of realism. Whereas very complicated modernist work. Anybody read James? Who's read James Joyce? Let me not say anybody. Who's read James Joyce? Well, I should have gone with the anybody. some really experimental 20th century writers. What?
Do short works count? That's a short story.
Yeah, they're pretty transparent compared to Ulysses or.
Ulysses is heavy.
Yeah. But one characteristic of modern literature that was very experimental was they did some verbal tricks that you couldn't see past the words on the page to the world. They were, I don't know that they were hypermediating it, but they were using style to prevent transparency, drawing their attention to the style so that you would think about the style rather than thinking about the subject, or in addition to thinking about the subject. So,
I wanted to just, I don't think we're going to get, at the rate we're moving, I'm not sure we're going to get to Snow Crash. But I wanted to do two things. I wanted to give us some context for 1984 and 1992, why those are two particularly interesting years for us. I'm just going to bring this up to show why those are interesting years. In 1984, an interesting novel was published.
George Orwell?
No, that's the title of a book you're thinking about, but it's not really directly relevant to the discussion. 1984, there was...
Just slide over to the side because the stuff at the bottom is...
Yeah, I'll zoom in a moment. Okay. 1984, this fellow wrote a book called Neuromancer. Neuromancer is sort of a prelude and sort of a tee-up for some things we're going to be talking about in the book Snow Crash. There was a very important term coined out of this book. Does anybody know what that term is? It could be one or two terms, but it's commonly attributed to both terms. One sort of a genre, and one is a term that you hear even Al Gore use today. Anybody have? Well, Al Gore invented the internet, obviously. We know that. We've established that. So, not sci-fi. No, sci-fi is a wee bit older than that. You hear people talking about it on the news, in common culture. Jay, help me out. Anywhere, you hear it all the time. It's just white noise in the system at this point. But at a time, there was a time before this, it wasn't.
Yeah, I don't think they were going to be able to guess.
I was just curious.
They guesses.
I wanted to try. So that's it. Cyberspace, and the book, the genre, the classification of book is called cyberpunk. But cyberspace is the term. You hear everybody surfing through cyberspace. This is the author to whom this is attributed, this term. Now, but I want you to place it in context a wee bit. I'm going to zoom in. This is, you can see down here, those of you looking, these are the 1980s, right? I'm going to zoom in. I'm just giving you some context. Look at where my cursor is. This is 1980 to 1985. So I'm going to zoom in a little bit so we can see it. But when you look up from 1984 period, Activision, Donkey Kong had only been out a couple years.
Where's Donkey Kong?
Donkey Kong's right here in 1981. The IBM PC was invented and deployed in the marketplace August of 1981. This whole period of time, when you're talking about Neuromancer, is an era where computers were not networked together. You folks were into a world that always had the internet. There was no internet. There was no connectivity. There were some minor dial-in things, but it was absolutely inconsequential. In that societal context, they invented Neuromancer. Then you fast forward to our discussion, 1992, that's when Neal Stephenson wrote Snow Crash. And it's a different world. It's where you're starting to see the internet. HTTP, the web browsing protocol you're used to, was already invented. Things were moving in the right direction. A year later, the internet was largely being commercialized throughout the world, primarily in North America. But just remember, two different contexts. William Gibson's Neuromancer set this up. And I wanted to show you something that was, this is going to be hypermediated a little bit. I wanted to show you something that was mentioned in the article, Strange Days. And then I want to show you something called Johnny Mnemonic, which was also a story written by William Gibson. And then I'll turn it back over to Professor Clayton to tee up a discussion on Snow Crash. This is Strange Days.
Have you ever jacked in? Have you ever wire tripped?
You ready?
This is not like TV, only better. This is
life. It's a piece of somebody's life. It's about the stuff that you can't have, right? The forbidden fruit. Straight from the cerebral cortex. I mean, you're there, you're doing it, you're feeling it.
Are you beginning to see the possibilities here?
I am your main connection to the switchboard of souls. I'm the magic man.
But it's got something to do with the wire. Sooner or later, it washes up on your beach.
Fan mail from some flounder?
It's the dark end of the street. How do you like it now?
He records it all. Everything.
And gives it to you.
Why me?
There's more to this whole thing than you think.
Give us the tape right now!
You know how high up the food chain this thing goes.
Do you know what this tape could do if it got out? I see the world opening up and swallowing us all.
This is conspiracy paranoia.
The issue isn't whether you're paranoid, Lenny. The issue is whether you're paranoid enough.
No more games. Whatever's going on, you have to get out of here now.
Get him out.
This tape is a lightning bolt from God. It can change things, things that need changing before we all go off the end of the road.
It'll be an all-out war, and you know it.
No! Well, maybe it's time for a war.
That gives you a sense of strange days. What you see there is someone's recording something that happened in real life, remediating it onto something you can enjoy through virtual reality. You're starting to see this virtual reality idea, this cyberspace, this metaverse idea come to life. Similar thing with Johnny Mnemonic, and I want to do 2 minutes on this, and just let me see. Johnny Mnemonic's another William Gibson story that's related to the same concept in the cyberpunk genre. A metaverse and the real world collide.
What are you doing?
Making a long distance phone call. Beijing Hotel. The year is 2021.
Reloading or not?
The world is wired.
Your storage capacity? I can carry nearly 80 gigs of data in my head.
Information is power. And secrets are a thing of the past. Unless you hire a courier like Johnny Mnemonic.
Hit me.
How do you fit all that in your head anyway?
I had to dump a chunk of long-term memory.
You had to dump a chunk of what?
My childhood.
For Johnny, inputting the data was easy.
Let's just start with what you got in there and what it's worth to the world.
The hard part is making the delivery.
Double cheese anchovies?
You weren't on the menu.
He's taking something, uploading into his mind, and he's a courier from point A to point B, and somebody wants it. You're seeing these some themes evolve in this cyberpunk genre, which I think should carry over neatly into our discussion around Snow Crash.
Well, you know, I don't want to go to Snow Crash. We only have 5 minutes left. What I'd love to do these last few minutes is you go back to your chronology and take us through 1984. Show us each of those, will you please?
Absolutely.
I think it's very interesting, and I found that it was, you know, too fast to absorb earlier. Just, you know, work us through.
Anybody familiar with...
Actually, start back there with that one that says Matthew Jett Hall. What happened then?
He was born.
Wow.
Yeah, really? 1969. Mm-hmm. And it's something interesting, I'll tell you guys how I relate to Neal Stephenson, is that Hiro, H-I-R-O, is employed by a firm. What's the name of the firm? Cosa Nostra Pizza Company, and he has a particular number, Cosa Nostra Pizza 3569. My birthday is 3569. Whoa! That should be the reaction as well.
So ARPANET was born the year you were born.
Absolutely.
And ARPANET was the military precursor to the internet.
That's correct.
So Matt Hall has always lived
in the metaverse,
in an internet capable world, unlike other people in this room.
But some of the far-fetched technologies that you think Ethernet there, if you fast forward a little bit at the bottom, it's right around the 1970, 1973 time frame, Ethernet is the general transmission vehicle for how the web, how the internet physically connects. So it didn't get commercialized and widely deployed in the market for 20 years. So inventions that you see today, the things around you on this table, are actually 20-year-old technologies. I want you to bear that in mind. It takes a long time to mass market, commercialize, and make it widely accessible. So when you see cyberpunk, when you see these cyberspace ideas, they're not as far-fetched as you think. There is mind control out there today as a human-computer interaction mode. And that modality you saw in the Minority Report for human-computer interaction is 5 minutes. That modality is in existence today in the market. One of our favorites.
You know what he meant by mind control? That is, on an experimental laboratory basis, they have gotten monkeys to move computer cursors with brain neuron signals. So we can't, they don't do it with humans because they can't put neurons into the brain. But monkeys and essentially we could, if wired, control a computer screen with our thoughts.
And you're seeing
so
this
that
very
exists. I'm amplify that.
That's fine. It's an important point to amplify because these control mechanisms that you see expressed in this literature are very much that main. You're going to find them come to the mainstream in people who have disabilities or paralysis. There's going to be very important human augmentation. So that if someone is disabled and paralyzed, they lose their motor functions. Today, people can control a computer by blinking. These are the types of things. And you're going to see that get more and more refined where that the internal neural plant implants that Professor Clayton refers are being externalized, and they're able to detect the electromagnetic activity, how it's localized, and what those thought processes are. So don't think this is far-fetched. This is real and available today in the laboratory and being commercialized over time. One of our favorites that people don't realize is Star Wars. When did Star Wars come out? Look at that period. 77. Star Wars. How did they do the fight scenes with the TIE fighters? Derek's right. Models. They had models and cameras on boom swinging. How does the modern day 2004 to 2008 Battlestar Galactica do so much massive?
Or even the later.
Even the later Star Wars.
CGI.
It's always.
And so when they went back to release the expanded version of Star Wars. He added little CGI creatures into some of the settings to kind of get them up to the visual richness of the later Star Wars movies.
Microsoft was formed in 75. You have Zork, the one I showed you in class, in the late 70s. The 70s and 80s started to see the convergence when of a firm called TSR. Lee, do you remember what TSR stands for? We'll let you tell the class next time. But TSR is a very important gaming company because it was the organization that invented and put forward Dungeons and Dragons. So you saw Dungeons and Dragons, you saw, and the guy who founded that was a guy named Gary Gygax, G-Y-G-A-X. You saw Dungeons and Dragons about the same time as you saw TCP/IP and the PC come to light. So you're seeing games get more sophisticated, the media gets in which they can be expressed get more sophisticated, so people are porting these games, Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, over to multi-user dungeons. They're D&D online, not the graphics you're used to today, but these are the precursors to these modern games. And you Final Fantasy guys, look, we're in 87s when your first Final Fantasy came out, right? And Neuromancer, right around that period of time. Donkey Kong in the 1980s, the Mac, the later editions of the Mac, the Apple II came out in the late 70s, the Mac came out at that point. King's Quest was one of the first 3D games that started to take things from a flat 2 dimensions and put it into 3D. So the rules became more complex, the graphics became more complex, and as the technologies increased, the visualizations got better, the capabilities got better. Who got to see the Neuromancer video on YouTube? Anybody see that?
I had to pausing it to read the text, though, because it was just, the person was scrolling through it so fast.
That was Neuromancer remediated to a computer game. It's the same conversation. We could have done this class in 87, 89, when that game came out, I can't remember the exact date, we could have put Neuromancer, did the game, but not had the shared experience that the network allowed. So these technologies allowed you to really interact in different ways as they continue to increase their power and their capabilities. Now everybody's stitched together. The network is the computer, and there's about 1.5 billion people, as we said, attached to the network, which gives you narrative and gameplay experiences like we've never thought of before. And one of Professor Clayton's favorites from a narrative perspective is a game called Myst.
and that was one of the most involved storytelling platforms renowned for its graphics capabilities.
Anybody ever play Myst?
Good.
So really, this 80s and 90s, it was a huge conflagration where the technologies started to combine with the various media and started to combine in the gaming space and the computer space. And this is where the Atari 2600 came up and started the idea of console games relative to PC games as well. So this was the birthplace in the 80s and 90s of these combined experiences, and that ends our class.
Thank you very much.
I thought that was a real fire alarm for a second. I was like, ooh.
Get out, Evan, roll, move.
No.
You need to
get on right now.
Why?
Because you had